Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
This message is brought to you by Cologuard. Cologuard is a one-of-a-kind way to screen for colon cancer if you are 45 or older and at average risk for colon cancer. It's uniquely effective because it is the only FDA-approved, non-invasive screening test that looks for both altered DNA and blood in your stool. You know, I've actually had personal experience using Cologuard. I loved that the test kit gets delivered right to your door so that you can collect your sample on your own.
And in addition to the convenience and ease of use, it also is affordable. Most insured patients paid $0.
We really want to emphasize to our friends and listeners how important it is to screen for colon cancer if you're 45 or older. So please talk to your healthcare provider about your screening options, including screening for colon cancer with Cologuard. Cologuard is available by prescription only. You can also request a Cologuard prescription today at Cologuard.com/podcast. Do not use Cologuard if you have had adenomas, have inflammatory bowel disease, and certain hereditary syndromes, or have a personal or family history of colorectal cancer. False positive and negative results may occur. Any positive result should be followed by a colonoscopy, not a replacement for a colonoscopy in high-risk patients. This story reflects one individual's experience. Not every person will have the same treatment, experience, outcome, or result.
Well, Stephen Dubner from Freakonomics and Angela Duckworth from Grit, the book, and beyond joined me in the second half for a very enlightening conversation. So I would say listen and share this conversation. I found it important. First, I'll tell you about LifeLock. Cyber criminals taking advantage of the pandemic, sending malware to scam people trying to learn about cures. They've even devised counterfeit online pharmacies. It's important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives. Every day, we put our info at risk on the internet. You could miss certain identity threats if you're just monitoring your credit alone. LifeLock detects a wide range of identity threats, like your social security number for sale on the dark web. Protect yourself. It's 2020. Get some insurance for your identity. Get LifeLock. If they detect your information has potentially been compromised, they will send you an alert. Right, Dawson?
If you become a victim of identity theft, LifeLock can help you restore your identity easier than what you can do on your own. No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. LifeLock can see threats you might miss on your own. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year by using promo code Adam. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK or head to LifeLock.com. Use promo code Adam for 25% off.
For just $25, you get wine and gifts. Ace's favorite stuff or products from ACS. Every single month, you get the drink you choose. It's hard to beat cool stuff and booze. Adam's Monthly Nut. Adam's Monthly Nut.
You heard Dick. It's time for a brand new month of Adam's Monthly Nut. This shipment includes a bug bite thing to suck out any mosquito bites you get while drinking Mangria in the summer sun. A You Can Frisbee Here frisbee, perfect for tossing at the beaches Newsom won't let you go to. An ACS koozie to keep your beer cold. And most importantly, let people know that this beer is yours. A ready patch for those who get a little rosy from drinking too many cold beers. And, of course, a bottle of your choice. This $60 value is yours for only $25. Order one or keep the shipments coming at CorollaDrinks.com.
Stephen Dubner, Angela Duckworth have joined the podcast. No Stupid Questions, that's the name of their podcast, explores the weird and wonderful ways in which humans behave. And new episodes are available every Monday on Apple Podcasts and Spotify as well. Stephen, of course, you know from Freakonomics, and Angela, for sure, from Grit. So, good. Let's solve all of the world's problems. Here we go.
Great.
We actually already solved them.
So oh, you did.
Okay, we're done.
Yeah. See you later. Nice talking to you.
I'm a big fan of Grit. I really feel like that's what's missing from a lot of young people. I'm a broken record about just sort of hard work and determination and all that kind of stuff. And so maybe we can just start with that. Maybe we can start with grit and how it factors in and pertains to raising kids. Like, I have a couple of 14-year-old twins, boy, girl, and I'm like to instill a little grit, but let's just start with that broad subject. What is grit? Well, how would we define grit?
I would define grit as the combination of having passion for a really long-term goal, something that might take years or decades even, sometimes a lifetime to accomplish, and then also perseverance to work really, really hard at that same goal. So passion and perseverance for especially long-term goals. That's what I call grit, and I study it because I do think it is a common denominator of high achievers, no matter what it is that you're trying to achieve.
So it is a universal quality that can be applied to really almost any facet of our society, as certainly any job. And we all know it. We all know the people that have it. Sadly, we know the people that don't have it. Stephen, how are you on the grit? What on the grit-o-meter, where would you be if 10 was Jocko Willink or somebody like that, or somebody just got up at 4 in the morning and you know, swam 1,000 laps and ran up a hill, you know, or all the famous guys and gals in the past that have grit? Where would you be?
Yeah, so Angela and I met a few years ago when we had her on Freakonomics Radio to talk about grit, and we went over this very question, and I rated myself, I think I ended up rating myself roughly an 8 on a scale of 10, but then Angela persuaded me that I was maybe comparing myself to, you know, like I was envisioning comparing myself to the people who are super, super, super gritty. And that maybe I'm actually a little bit higher because I don't totally suck. I'm not as lazy as I think I am. I sometimes think of myself as being pretty lazy, but when I actually look and keep score at the end of the day or at the end of the week, like how much I work and how hard I work, especially on things that aren't succeeding, I think I'm pretty gritty. But I will tell you this, and this is what I am most interested in about grit, is how do you get grit if you don't have it? Because as a kid, I can't say I had a great work ethic or was particularly gritty. Like I quit a lot of stuff. If there was something I really enjoyed, I would do it endlessly. But if it was something I didn't enjoy or I wasn't good at, I was like, next. And so I know that Angela talks about grit, you know, being this combo of passion and perseverance, and that you can only really have perseverance for something that you're passionate about. But to me, the secret sauce here, like the big mystery, and this is a lot of what we explore, you know, honestly on Freakonomics Radio, but on No Stupid Questions too, is how you can, I mean, I hate this language about hack and, you know, all these shortcuts, but like basically how you can get better at doing stuff. That's what I'm interested in. Not just for my kids or for your kids, Adam, but for myself, you know, like I feel we're all works in progress, and I want to keep learning how to get better at stuff. So really, this new podcast we made is just so I can cheat and pick Angela's brain and try to get a little grittier.
Well, let's talk grit with Angela, obviously. And also, I want to address, and I want to know what Angela's thought on this is feeling like there's a lazy person trapped inside a gritty person's body. I totally identify with that. I've talk to guys like Dennis Prager, the radio show host, and he says all the time, I am lazy by nature. That's why I work so hard. It's a constant, it's like, it's a relationship that some people have with sobriety. It's like, I got to go to a meeting every night. Otherwise, I'll drink a bathtub full of gin and get on the roof with a crossbow. Like, it's a job that they literally overcompensate for feeling like there's a lazy person trapped inside of them. I feel the same way. Do you feel that way, Angela? Or is that a real thing?
I do not feel that way. I do not feel like even that there is the hint of laziness. So here's what I'm hearing though, right? Is that there is some standard of hard work that you hold yourself to. Otherwise, you just wouldn't care, right? Like you just, you know, continue to lie on the couch and not get off of it. And so you have to like fight that. And then you're, but my guess is, you know, just looking at what you've done, and I know Stephen well enough, not only just looking at what he's done, but, you know, having, you know, been a collaborator, that neither of you are anything close to lazy, right? That you're not 40-hour a week people either. Is that right? I mean, first, let me just start with that, Adam. Adam, is that correct that you're not somebody who
like... Adam puts out more than 40 hours of podcasts a week.
There's a couple things. You know, it's not really are you a lazy person by nature or not? It's that, do you feel like a lazy person? And almost like there's people who exercise all the time because when they look in the mirror, they see like a heavy set person looking back at them, but they're not.
Yeah.
They're in good shape. Yeah, we call it body dysmorphic disorder, but I may have a lazy dysmorphic disorder, which is like,
you maybe have
I look in the mirror and I see a lazy guy looking back at me and I think, oh, you better outwork your lazy ass this week.
Right. Like you get up earlier tomorrow, work later. Well, I think it's very related to Stephen rating himself an 8 out of 10 on grit. It's like, by what comparison, like to what standard? I mean, maybe he has the same thing you do, right? And you have this warped image of yourself, which other people might say, are you kidding me? You're incredibly hardworking and gritty, but you don't feel that way. Does that, I do find, by the way, people at the top of the grit scale tend to judge themselves quite harsh and always holding themselves to a higher and higher and higher standard.
It's also a situation where the people you are aware of or that you have relationships with or what have you, or, you know, Jimmy Kimmel or guys like that, who obviously would be off the charts in the work ethic. But to me, he's someone to compare myself to. You know, it wasn't. Now, if I was back on a construction site in North Hollywood and comparing myself to those assholes I work with, then I would look at myself differently. So it's like, sort of who's traveling in your group. And Stephen, you probably have a high achieving group that you're traveling with, so you're comparing yourself to those people.
Right. And I realize that's my mistake. You should hang out with losers and lazy people and then you'll feel relatively awesome. So
you'll feel great. You won't be great, but you'll feel great. Here's a way, you know, when psychological surveys, when behavioral scientists ask people to, you know, rate themselves, you know, they're always thinking that you're rating yourself against like humanity, right? Mm-hmm. Like which you're not. You're rating yourself against some peer group that's probably not at all the way somebody else is rating because they have a different peer group. But here's the way to do it. When's the last time you went to the DMV to renew your license, right? Yes. That's basically a random sample of, well, at least American adults.
Right. I'm in 11 now.
Okay, well, yeah. So if you just remember sitting in that room, you're like, okay, because everyone needs to renew their license. That might help you guys out. But I do think having this kind of almost unapproachable standard, this, you know, as soon as you like achieve one thing, you're like looking up, not down. I think that's actually part of what drives gritty people.
Okay. Right? But can I just say, no offense to the three of us, but the three of us now kind of sound like we're humble bragging.
Yes. I know this is like, I think one, it's actually big, just
like
bragging.
Oh, I'm only an 8, but I know that I'm really like an 11.
All right. Well,
humble bragging or just
I don't
bragging.
Mean to trash us because we're three decent humans, I think, but I do think that what Angela's doing, Adam, seriously, is really important work in her research and in this thing called the Character Lab that she has, because like, if grit is valuable, which almost all of us agree it is, right? Then you ask, like, where does it come from? Angela will tell you a lot of hers comes from her family, both culturally and genetically, or hereditarily, I guess we should say, right? This Chinese family that was like, what are you talking about? You're not going to work for 6 hours on this thing. Of course you are. And we all know that families and environments and so on contribute to that. But to me, the big question is, if a kid or an adult, whatever, doesn't have the environment, you know, that Angela lucked into, I mean, no offense to you, Angela, you were born into a great circumstance. I feel like I was born into a family that, you know, very different from yours, but pretty good. But if you don't have that, how do you get it yourself, especially when you're still a young person? That to me is an incredibly valuable and almost heartbreaking question because, you know, I'm not worried about us.
Right. And you're not even worried about Adam's 14-year-old twins.
No, I'm not. Because any dad who's worried enough to worry about
and Adam's
them,
not worried about
they're Adam's fine. 14-year-old.
No, I think you're right. So let me paint a picture of what I think like the ideal conditions for development are. Probably for most things, honestly, and not just grit, but I'll try to be a little more specific about like what we would want for young people at age 14 or so, or even younger, is lots of opportunities to try out lots of different things. And by the way, I'm going to paint a picture of kids doing what you did, Stephen, which is quit things, right? So like Will Shortz, people think of, you know, crossword editor for the New York Times. I mean, it is true. He discovered very early in life that he wanted to be basically a puzzle master, unusual career, and he discovered this unusually young. But even he tried out things like guitar, et cetera, that he quit. And that's actually what you want. You would want to wave a magic wand so that all of these kids around the world, children and teenagers, would have lots of opportunities to try things out and actually paradoxically, you know, coming from me maybe, to quit them when they have gotten far enough to know that they want to do something else. And when you said when you were a kid, Stephen, that you quit lots of things, but you worked very hard, even obsessively, on the things that kind of stuck with you, right? That like, I don't know, rang your bell or whatever. Like that's actually what I see in gritty people, that they quit a lot of things. They go from one to the other, especially when they're young, but they do have increasingly, you know, I guess like strong constitution to stick with the things that start to stick with them.
Yeah. I wonder, Adam, I don't mean to ask questions of the other guest on your show. Do you mind if I ask her one question?
Please.
So when you talk to all these high achievers, when you were writing Grit and so on, I'm curious, I think you did write about this. I just don't remember, but you know, it reminds me of the three of us now kind of assessing ourselves maybe a little bit lower and that humble brag of the thing. But on the flip side of that, I do wonder how much self-awareness is a factor in grit or success of any kind, which is being able to really look at yourself and see, you know, yes, I'm really good at what I do. Or, yeah, I really bust my ass at this. But here's an opportunity I missed, or here's something I didn't think through, or here's where I could have gone further. And that itself being a major component of success. Is that the case or not really?
Yeah. And so one of the reasons why it's hard to give a straight or at least a short answer to like, okay, what do all kids need so that they have the opportunity to develop, you know, something like grit, is that it's more than one thing. I got yelled at, actually. I had a very, very, very famous professor of psychology who I used to work with when I was, well, I worked for as an undergraduate. He was, I think, the chair of the psychology department at Harvard. And his name is Jerry Kagan. And I caught up with him a few years ago. So I was all grown up. I had become a professor myself. And, you know, he had heard about grit and we were talking on the phone. And he was kind of yelling at me. Like, it was like listening to all caps with exclamation marks. And I think his beef was that grit requires many things. It's like complicated, right? So it's not just that you need the exploration of multiple interest possibilities and you got to sample them and quit them. And that's part of developing grit. Also developing self-awareness, especially an ability to be self-critical. You're absolutely right, Stephen. That's also a part of what you need to develop grit. But then, you know, you also need role models and mentors. Like that's so it's a long recipe. And I think Jerry said that maybe it was such a long recipe that it may not have been a useful recipe. But I do think this is kind of the phenotype, if you will, of a high achiever. So when we start reverse engineering, like what are all the things that these people have that enable them to stick with things for so long with such an obsessive single-mindedness, you do find it. It's like more than one factor.
I'd like to discuss self-esteem and how this factors or folds into grit as well, because I'm starting to worry that too many people have too high a self-esteem. And it's funny because you look at self-esteem like vitamin C, like, well, you can never have enough vitamin C. I think you can. I think you'll get the runs at a certain point. And I've found
psychological runs.
I've kind of studied, like I work with comedians and comedians are really moody and temperamental and kind of nutty and finicky and difficult. And I noticed that Jay Leno was probably the easiest of all the comedians to deal with. And he sat in the studio a couple of weeks ago. And I said, Jay, I'm just kind of asking, like, why are you willing to do, he'll hop in any dragster, he'll jump in any crop dusting biplane. I'll call him up and go, Jay, come over there, and he'll come over. Or I'll go to his shop and just walk in.
I'm gonna call him. This is great.
It's easy. And he just goes, I have low self-esteem. Like, I just, whatever. I don't have any self-esteem. And I go.
He's surprised when people are inviting him to the, you know, annual crop dusting.
He understands that he's rich and he understands that he's successful.
He's famous,
yeah. But he doesn't have high self-esteem. He has this kind of, ah, shucks, regular guy or whatever. And I've heard people talk to him. Like, I've been on the set of The Tonight Show, and I've heard, like, his head writer during rehearsal go, hey, Jay, you're doing it wrong, and you're screwing up the joke. Now get it right, otherwise we're going to cut the joke. And I sit there, like, I hold my breath, like, oh, my God, if you said that to half the other guys I've worked with in this town, you'd be fucking fired. And Jay would be like, oh, well, how do you want me to do it? And he'd go, well, you're hitting the wrong beats. And he'd go, oh, okay, sorry, I'll try it again. And that's the no self-esteem or low. And so I started thinking about groups with really high self-esteem, and I realized I don't think they're doing as well as low self-esteem groups. And I think I started thinking about all the Jewish writers I've hung out with since I got, you know, when I got out of construction, there were no Jews in construction. When I got into show business, there were a lot of Jews. And they're the most self-deprecating group in the world. I've never hung out with more guys going, I'm so bad at fixing things. You call the guy. I don't even pop the hood of the car. I don't even know where the engine is. Believe me, I am lame. I'm like they're really self-deprecating in a funny way, but hard on themselves. Yeah. I got off a construction site where it was all Gentiles and Mexicans, and I got into a writer's room, and it was all Jewish men. And no group was more self-deprecating than Jewish men. Like, I'm so bad at this, or
and
that
they,
was so lame.
They weren't just joking either. It wasn't
they joke about it, but it's like, I couldn't change a light bulb in my apartment if you gave me $10,000 in an hour. You know, I couldn't. I'm so bad. But even when they write a bad joke, they'd go, that was lame. It's stupid.
All right. Given that you have two 14-year-olds, I cannot. Well,
I'm not Jewish, but I'm Italian. But I also noticed, so the groups that I noticed that were very hard on themselves were Asians and Jews. The Asians for kind of different reasons, but they were hard on themselves. I don't mean negative. I just mean
right.
Tough.
And you don't mean depressed.
No, I don't mean depressed.
You just mean like tough on themselves, right? Like judging themselves by very tough standards.
Is that one way to put it? Yeah. And then I started thinking, well, wait a minute. The two groups that are really kicking ass in this country are Asians and Jews. So I thought, well, maybe there's something, because I know a bunch of people that feel really good about themselves and are horrible and don't do anything.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is a very dangerous question to ask a Jew and an Asian, or at least it's dangerous for us to answer. Like, look, this is what self-esteem is. Self-esteem is your feeling of worth. Like, do you feel like you're on an equal level with others? Do you think you're, you know, of value, like in the world? If I had two 14-year-old twins, I would want them to have some threshold level of self-esteem. Actually, having like really low self-esteem is highly associated with like bad things like depression. So, I don't think you want your kids to be in the basement on self-esteem, but I think you have a very good intuition, which is probably that, you know, beyond some threshold level, you know, more isn't necessarily better. But here's something that I think you do want. First of all, you want humility. Mm-hmm. Like that's what when you describe people who like Jay Leno saying like, oh, how can I make this joke better? What do I need to do? That's humility. And you can have self-esteem and humility at the same time, because they're not, you know, they're not opposites of each other. And let me just throw one other word in here. And I know it's kind of jargony, but it's actually the word that psychologists use. It's called self-efficacy. So if I had two 14-year-old twins, I'd want them to have some threshold level of self-esteem, but I'd really want them to have a lot of self-efficacy. Self-efficacy isn't believing that you're worthwhile. Self-efficacy is believing that if you tried, you can do something. And I don't know that there is a lot of downside to even being 10 out of 10 in self-efficacy. Because, you know, when you get to 10 out of 10 on self-efficacy, basically the responsibility is on you to then go try.
I
think there's this movement. I think what Adam's identifying, though, Angie, maybe I'm wrong, Adam, you can tell me, is this movement for like the last, I don't know, 20, 30 years, like especially with very young children in schools, this idea that like, let's tell the children they're awesome at everything and then they will be awesome at everything. In other words, self-esteem is like the fuel that you need to be good at stuff, as opposed to the old model, which was, no, you deserve no self-esteem until you've busted your ass and have gotten really good. So obviously somewhere in the middle is better, but I do think just as most corrections are overcorrections, I think like the hard-ass style of parenting that we can all agree was probably a little bit too hard-ass for, you know, a couple millennia, like a lot of beatings and so on, it was replaced by a way too easy, which I saw a lot in when my kids are now teenage, you know, college age. But I saw it a lot when they were younger, which is the whole school would be geared around like telling the kids how wonderful and awesome and chosen they were. And it led to a bunch of kids feeling really entitled. And, you know,
is it possible that like that a school, a teacher, say, could give a kid a sense that they're valuable people, like they're worthy of being respected and loved, but that is totally separate from like, you already know how to do this.
Totally.
This essay is already great. Because I think you want to, and that's like nuanced, right? But like, I think that's what you're trying to do as a parent too, right? You don't want your kid to think that you love them 7 out of 10. You want them to think you love them 10 out of 10, but that doesn't mean that everything that they do, like every single act, every deed is already perfect.
Right. But that's like, to me, the whole point of unconditional love, of parental love, which is I love you despite the fact that you suck at things right now. And because I can tell you that you suck at things right now, I can actually help you get better at things. That's to me. By the way, I'm Jewish and I did construction.
Wow.
I only did it for a summer. It was so fucking hard.
How'd that pyramid come out?
I didn't know Jews didn't do construction. That's a new cultural.
There's a lot we don't do, Angie. I'll give you the list later.
Not out in SoCal. Well, no, it was the thing that was very interesting culturally, and it's why I don't mind stereotypes. I they're earned. I am the same person I was, you know, when I was 30, 29. I was on a construction site from high school and beyond. I've just worked as a laborer and then I became a carpenter, but nobody ever mistook me for a Jew. And then as soon as I got into comedy, everyone thought I was Jewish, and I didn't change a thing about myself. Right. It just became Jewish when I wrote jokes, and the hair was the same and the look was the same. It was just the profession changed. But I think what I'm talking about, and maybe what we're all kind of dancing around a little bit with self-esteem, is self-esteem that is earned is good. Self-esteem that's grafted onto every 9-year-old is bad. It's just, you cannot just hand people self-esteem.
I took I have two daughters. The younger one's named Lucy, and she decided she wanted to run track. I guess she must have been, I don't know, maybe 10 or 11, right? And we show up, and there's 8 kids in the meet, and she's 8th out of 8. And she comes back to where I'm sitting with a ribbon, right? And it said 8th, like, you know, like, so I don't think you need to give all 8 kids in an 8-person race a ribbon. She was also on this little soccer team.
Did you tear up the ribbon or burn it?
Even at that age, I mean, she was what, 10? Like, I was like, this is like a New Yorker cartoon. It's like, I just started laughing, and she laughed too, because she recognized even that young age, she was like, this is absurd. Like, I can't believe I just got a ribbon. So I didn't have to rip it up. It was just a object of humor.
I had the exact same experience, which is, my son came in 8th and like, I guess he was doing like long distance stuff. And And he came in eighth. And when he came in eighth, I said to my wife, we were sitting up in the bleachers of the high school, the cross country meet. I said, okay, I'll go get the car. And she said, no, no, we have the podium ceremony.
Exactly.
I said, what's she? Is she going to stand on a cookie sheet or are we going to dig a hole for him to stand in? And it's like, no, no, there's the podium. There's the ceremony with the podium. I'm like, yeah, the podium is first, second, and third. He's eighth. It's like, oh, no, we got the ceremony. I'm like, okay. All right.
It's not a trend that I like. But I don't think it's the same thing as like telling kids that they're, you know, like, you know what I'm saying? Like great coaches and parents, they make kids feel great about themselves as people, but they separate the kid as a person from like the action that they just did. And actually, you know, there's a lot of scientific research showing like if you're praising your kid, it's so much better to focus your attention and your feedback. I mean, both positive and negative, frankly, on like what they're doing, right? Like, if, you know, if they bake a cake, you know, don't talk about them as a person and their worth and whatever. Just talk about the cake. It's like a little dry, actually, like needs more frosting. But focus on the process, not the person. That's the thumbnail sketch of the science on it.
How does this work from an educational standpoint? Like, what could we implement into the school systems? I feel like they're so archaic.
Were you a good student, Adam, when you were, you know, middle school? Like you were the 14.
Let's recap. I left high school. I walked onto a construction site and I picked up garbage for a living.
So not such a good student.
You may want to pull up a trash can to throw up into because the Asian mom in you is going to want to heave when I tell you that I never took the SATs.
Did not take the SATs.
College was not in the plan, so why bother with the charade of the SATs? I did not take the SATs.
But you learned how to pronounce charade.
That is very important.
Right, so that's something.
I did not take the SATs. I never took algebra in college. Oh, sorry, I didn't go to college. In high school or junior high, I took math. In high school, I took something called high school math, but not algebra. I was a ceramics major, which is paying great dividends today, in case anyone stops me on the street.
Fallback career.
Wants to know the difference between a coil pot and a slab pot. I'm all answers. And I finished with a 1.7 GPA, but you have to back out six. I went to high school for 3 years. There were six semesters of baseball and football in there, which was just an automatic A. So if you backed out six A's,
you were getting negative.
1.7 GPA. And I failed biology and driver's ed. Not driver's training, but driver's ed. Those are the two classes.
That's impressive.
I failed. And I never got my diploma because I owed the book room money. For a history book, I never returned, so I never physically got my diploma. So in terms of education, I don't know that you could do any worse than that.
Were you a bad student?
That's exactly what I was going to ask. What were you doing with all your time? Same question.
I had kind of a hippie mom in the 70s. And I went to what was called sort of an alternative school where you kind of learn to, you know, free range, you know, and you didn't have to buckle down and learn anything or do anything. And so from basically zero to the fifth grade, I didn't learn to spell or write or read. So I couldn't read or spell. So at some point I entered the public school system. And when I entered the public school system, I was like the character Nell from the movie, like a feral child who'd been raised in the woods. And I just sort of walked in. I remember weird things, like a bell rang and someone looked at me and went, we better get going. We're going to be tardy. And I was like, what's tardy? By the way, tardy doesn't exist really anywhere except for the school.
Except for report cards.
Right,
I know.
Bell.
No one ever says
and
tardy.
I was like, I don't know what any of this is. And I couldn't read and I couldn't write. And so I just sat in the back of the class But I didn't want anyone to know I couldn't read and couldn't write because I was horribly ashamed and embarrassed. So I would just kind of sit there and nod. And like when they handed me stuff, I would pretend like I was reading it. You know, if somebody said, hey, isn't this a funny comic? And they would hand it to me, I'd look at it and I'd try to time how long would a person who knew how to read look at this comic? And then at some point I'd go, that's funny. Yeah, that's a good one. And I'd hand it back. And that's how I just went through. I went all the way through junior high. I went through high school. That's how I got through. I never
did. And then how did you like turn, you know, this like, this narrative doesn't sound like it's going to end very well, but you're in the middle of a pretty good life. So like then, you know, what happened?
I learned a lot about grit through sports and about kind of overachieving, playing football and really working hard to make my way onto the varsity team. And then when I got onto the construction side, I learned a lot. I used a lot more of the grit from like, I don't want to be the guy digging ditches and cleaning up garbage. I want to be a carpenter, you know? So I really worked hard and used a lot of grit, you know, to work my way up to being a carpenter and to having a, you know, truck and not having to sweat it out, you know, in a ditch all day and be inside putting on crown molding or something a little more interesting. And then I just went, well, this life, it just sounds like a lot of hard work and a lot of people that I don't want to really want to work with. Like the guys aren't very interesting and the conversation's not fascinating or riveting.
Not scintillating.
No. And you didn't get paid. The job of carpentry was you didn't get paid if you didn't work. So if it rained on a Wednesday and the job site was closed, you didn't get paid for Wednesday. You didn't get paid. Right. You didn't get paid for Christmas. There's no holidays. There's no insurance. There's no nothing. It was just show up, work, you know, $13 an hour, however many hours we worked that week. And I no dental, no medical, no nothing. And I just sort of looked at it and I went, what's this going to be like when you're 45? You know, like you're 23, fine, shits and giggles. But man, when you're older, what is this going to be like? And I kind of did the math where it's like, well, you work your way up to foreman, you know, and you'll get a bigger truck. But I was like, yeah, but you're still going to be on this job site with these dudes. And what do you want to do? And so I was like insanely pragmatic. I was like, I cannot fill out an application. Like I physically could not fill out an application. I'm not going to succeed in any job that involves paperwork or organization. I cannot work in a traditional environment. I could work on a construction site, or maybe I could do comedy, but I couldn't work in an attorney's office or anything.
Be an accountant.
I didn't have any
number of things.
I couldn't spell. Yeah. I didn't have any skills. I didn't have any organization as you would learn it. And I didn't have any of that stuff. So I was like, well, you're funny. So what does that mean? And I thought, I don't really know what it means. It just means you're going to start working on comedy while you're doing construction and we'll see what happens. And so I started taking groundlings classes while I was working construction, and I didn't know what I was doing. And they were telling me like, yeah, you're funny, but you don't know how to act. So take an acting class and then you could come back and take the intermediate class. And I was like, okay, where's the acting class? I go over there on Ventura Boulevard, blah, blah, blah. I'd go, okay. I go take the money I was making swinging a hammer, which was, you know, I was making $12 an hour. I didn't have insurance for my truck or anything. And I was just handing it over to the groundlings or to the acting class, or I'd take free classes. I'd take classes in churches and basements and everywhere. And I was like, I don't know what's going on, but I better learn about comedy because I already know about carpentry and it sucks. So
were you more driven than the other aspiring comedians that were like in your groundling group or these other? I mean, did you work harder? Were you more intense? Were you more obsessive?
I had a higher level of discomfort. Most of the people at the groundlings were college educated. Everyone was a college graduate. they seem to come from some semblance of a family, and they had some place with air conditioning they could kind of go back to or something. And I didn't have any of that. They drove Jettas, and I drove Datsun pickup trucks, you know, with a bench seat. And so it's like they had a credit card. I didn't have a credit card. You know, they had a sort of a life for themselves that was a little more normal. So they could, like, go out to dinner and see a movie and turn the air on in their car and, you know, so on and so forth. So I had a little more fire in my belly. I had a little more desperation of, I got to hurry up and I got to figure this out. And you guys, some of these guys had dads who were attorneys or, you know, had businesses, family businesses. They could go into the business or something. I didn't have a family fallback. I was just going back onto the construction site. So I had a lot more desperation.
So since your kids are going to grow up, nothing like the way you grew up, like, right? I mean, like, how do you think they'll turn out?
You know, I think if they find something they're passionate about, and I don't want to sound cliche, but I just mean, when it comes to like comedy, the backgrounds are so varied. I mean, they're people, you know, Conan O'Brien's parents were like professors and he went to Harvard, you know. There's no further from mine. Even Jimmy's background is very different than my background. And so is every other comedian. I'm sure Dave Chappelle's background is much different than Conan O'Brien's background, but they agree on comedy. You know what I mean? And that's what kind of separates. So when you have a passion for something, then that'll pull from all different directions and like all different walks of life into that passion, because you just can't get more diverse than comedy. If you really look at how many different backgrounds there are and how they all ended up in the same place. So I just want my kids to have a passion. And then I think they'll have the motivation.
I agree. So if you talk about grit as passion and perseverance, a lot, you know, yes, I'm an Asian mom, but I don't consider myself a tiger mom. And one reason why is that I think passion comes first. And kids, you know, when Stephen talks about like, oh, he worries about like other people's kids who don't have opportunities, I worry that I worry about all the kids who don't have a chance to try out stuff and like give up on it and then try out another thing and go on a field trip and then eventually find something that you love so much that you'll never, ever get bored of it, which I bet you would feel like that about comedy, that like, it's never going to be like done. It's never like all the problems are gonna be solved or like there's no nuances or like people aren't doing new creative things that you want to hear about. So really what kids need is an opportunity to develop passion. You know, they need a little work ethic and perseverance too. But mostly when you're 14, you should be getting your interest sparked in different ways and like figuring that out.
I also think that if you have that work ethic and the grit we speak about, that you can develop it from sports or playing an instrument or some other discipline, swimming, you know, cross country running, you know, you take that, you're not going to make a living doing cross country running or swimming or probably playing an instrument or playing football like I did. But I was able then just to transfer it. So I just went, oh, I'm going to take this thing I learned about hard work and overcoming and sort of pushing through the pain and discomfort, and I'm just going to transfer that onto.
You know, not everyone does though. You know, that's it's very interesting that I think that's exactly why parents send their kids to, you know, music lessons and join teams, right? I mean, not many parents are thinking like, oh, my daughter or son's going to become a professional violinist or like a, you know, professional athlete. I think that's exactly why we think that they're going to learn lessons about life that transfer. But what's interesting to me is like not everybody does transfer. In fact, human beings by default, we really struggle to transfer like generalizable lessons. So there are plenty of kids who don't transfer those insights. Why do you think you did? Like, did somebody point it out to you, or did you just sort of like see life? You saw what you were doing on the field and you like just drew the parallel by yourself.
You know, I think first thing, we probably have to agree that there's a kind of a baseline of intelligence that you need that I don't know how you measure it, but we'll just call it a sort of universal intelligence that lets you get from here to there. Like just that's a kind of a, I had a baseline intelligence, even though I was completely uneducated.
It was not reflected in your grades.
Right.
You were thinking.
I was thinking well. Yes. I come from chaos. My family was a mess. Everything was broken down and poor and the grades were through the basement floor, but I had a kind of a baseline intelligence that would help to navigate me into making better decisions if I didn't have that baseline of intelligence. I don't know where it came from, but it was just a sort of a base. And I realize a lot of the guys I grew up with who came from similar circumstances and ended up, you know, with the broken families on the construction sites, they lacked that sort of base, like that baseline intelligence that would let them, it wouldn't propel them to the next thing. It would just let them go to the next thing. It would not prevent them from getting to the next endeavor.
Right.
But they just didn't have that base. And that's then becomes the most unsolvable Rubik's Cube ever, which is if you don't have that base, how do you then apply
those lessons?
Yeah, and also it's a weird thing, which is there, two of my closest friends were really successful as really young people. One of them worked at Kentucky Fried Chicken for like 5 years, saved up like $3,000 and bought his own car. And I was like really impressed by that. Like when he was 17, you know, I was like, he worked there and I wasn't working. I wasn't doing saving any money. I had another friend that had like a paper route, saved up, had a bunch of money in the bank, you know, a bunch of money. It was $1,800, but I was worth $10 in, you know, total if you liquidated everything. And I was like really impressed by it. And those guys both got started young doing that. And they both ended up being failures, basically. Like they didn't.
I hope they're listening.
They didn't transfer any of that into. We're talking about like transferring the positive.
Right. Were they not thinking? Were they like, so when you say baseline of intelligence, I mean, like it sounds like you thought like, and you thought well, right? Like just to make it into a verb.
I thought, well, things must change in order for me to get from here to there, and I need to do a lot of changing.
And they were not asking questions like that.
No, they were not asking, like, how can I evolve?
Another $3,000 and another car.
What did the paper delivery guy do with his money?
He probably bought a truck or a car or something, you know, outside in high school or what have you. And, you know, these guys end up just working schlubs, you know, regular working guys. I mean, they're not, you know, they're not in prison. And I don't, you know, I'm not calling them losers. Like, I know it sounds like a real pejorative, but I just mean is they had a lot of potential and they didn't really end up utilizing that potential. I probably had maybe less potential, but was able to sort of transfer it and grow it.
I think a lot of this is a habit. My dad raised me so my parents weren't actually classic tiger parents. Like they never asked me for my report card. I mean, they were just busy. And so they had their hands full with other things. So they weren't classic tiger parents. But I will tell you one thing that my mom and especially my dad did, he just modeled for me because this is the way he lived. He was just always thinking. And you know, you watch television and you could watch television or you could think about what's going on. And that to me is what I hear about, despite your poor grades, you were thinking and you were thinking well, and maybe the habit of thinking is pretty much what intelligence is. That's a little deep and I know we're running out of time. But
no,
anyway.
No, I think you're right in that I always call it like a sort of a constant calibrating. You know, it's just a constant calibration, like they do with the radar dish on the side of your house. Like, you know, I mean, if you ever see those guys adjust that DirecTV dish, like they have an instrument. It's like two clicks, you know, of latitude and half a click of longitude. And it's like you're watching the TV and you can make it out, but it starts getting really clear with just little constant subtle clicks, you know. And I was always in the mindset of calibration. Where are you?
Right.
What don't you know? What should you know? Where are your weaknesses? Where are your
is
strengths?
Is this thing that I think I know really true? Maybe it's not true. I think that is a habit. I don't think you have to be doing that. You could also not be doing that, or you could be doing that very little. And I think if your two 14-year-old twins, you know, get a little bit of work ethic, lots of opportunities to try things out so they can find a passion. And if they get into the habit of basically like thinking and thinking well, I think that'll be okay.
Yeah, maybe. I also think that too many people think with themselves in mind. Like they're looking, everything they factor in factors themselves in heavily. So yeah. They're like driving down the freeway. It's like, hey, that asshole just cut me off. He's cut me off. It's like he didn't cut you off. He just cut a car off that you're in. You know what I mean? Yes. He doesn't know who you are.
Like, they need to take a third person perspective.
Right. And your boss fired you because your boss is a dick. You know, it's like he fired you because you're a worker who's not doing a good job for him or her. That's why you're fired. It's pretty straightforward. Like I would argue and ask, could you remove yourself from the equation more often when it comes to decision making? You'll have a clear path if you back yourself out. Steven?
Yeah.
I wonder if the paradox, though, is if you've got high self-esteem, you have a really hard time removing yourself from it. Like, you know, there's all this research that I love in psychology and in economics about the role that luck and randomness play in life. And it's huge. And we don't like to admit that because we like to, we like to admit that bad things are the result of luck and good things are the result of our own thing. So yeah, it's just so interesting to me to hear you describe, you know, your life story. And like, you know, one part of me just gets pissed and wants to say, why didn't someone say or notice, like, wait a minute, this kid's in fifth grade and not reading, and he's plainly bright enough to be reading. Maybe, who knows, maybe you had some, you know, mild dyslexia, whatever. I have no idea. But like, that pisses me off. But then on the flip side, I think, well, you know, you got on this kind of alternate route, right? So you're in school, but you're not doing what the kids who are trying to be good at school are doing. And in a way, that sounds like it was the training for you to become what you ultimately became by being an observer and by calibrating all the time as you described it. And that is removing yourself from the, you know, I'm not thinking about how am I going to do on this test, because it sounds like you didn't give a shit how you would do on the test, but you started to become a student of human nature. And look, that's what you ended up parlaying into what you do. I'm not saying that was a guaranteed success. I'm sure a lot of people could have been in your situation educationally and have it turned out really poorly. The thing that I hear both of you guys saying, like when I think about self-esteem versus whatever, encouragement, to me, what's intoxicating in life is accomplishment. Just the sense of like, it can be an incredibly small thing. Like Angie and I were talking about this on our show not long ago. My dad died when he was pretty young and he had all kinds of physical illnesses and mental health stuff. And he, when he was at his lowest, he just had this mantra of move the muscles, just get up and do anything physically to kind of break this routine. And when I first started reading about this stuff that he had been inspired by, I thought, I don't understand how something so simple, so small can be useful. But then the more I read and the more I saw in myself, when I would get down, I would see that, yeah, sometimes it's literally the act of picking up the dirty dishes and marching them to the sink. And maybe you'll wash them, maybe you won't. But you get that tiny hit of whatever it is, dopamine, Angie, you could tell us, whatever it is that you get from
dopamine, probably
from fulfilling the thing that you set out to fulfill. And the more I learn about psychology and so on, the more I see that our minds are never happier, are never more engaged than when we have that little mental checklist of the things upcoming that we want to accomplish. They can be big, they can be small. And that's what I feel is important for everyone at any level, is to get that sense of accomplishment. Because, you know, we all, I think it's very popular these days to think about, wouldn't it be great if I could be given something? And, you know, yeah, for the first 5 minutes, and then for the 80 years after that, no, it's really not. And that to me is the riddle, the puzzle of how to kind of sell people, or to get people to buy into the notion that accomplishment on any level, on any dimension, is amazingly good for you and therefore good for everybody else. And it is intoxicating, and it does have a crescendo. It keeps building. So, you know, when I hear your story, Adam, you know, I think back to my childhood. I'm sure everybody listening to you thinks back to their childhood and thinks, yeah, you know, I wasn't very good or very gritty or very successful or blah, blah, blah. But then these small steps you accomplish, and then you look back and you think, man, I really know how to do stuff now. It's like, to me, it's one of the joys of being older, is like you have the perspective to say, yeah, I would not have been able to do the book that I'm going to write this year. I would not have been able to do that when I was 25 years old. I did not have the ability to plan it out, to think it through, to chunk it up into goals and so on. And that's like, to me, that's inspiring. I love to read stories of that success. On the other hand, I don't like all like the success porn that's going around right now. Like a lot of podcasts and a lot of, you know, hold.
I have never heard that expression.
I hadn't either, porn. But it's good.
Well, but like whole sections of the bookstore are basically like, it reminds me a little bit of the worried well. That's another phrase, like, you know, the doctors are getting clogged up by the people who have enough access and money to healthcare to come in with every hangnail and every pimple and so on. And I get it, but you know, the people who are obsessed with more success, I think, is blocking out a little bit the idea that we need to make success more accessible for more people. And part of that is hearing stories that are unlike ours and figuring out how to basically game the system, how to help everybody get drunk on accomplishment of whatever kind.
Success porn, I was thinking, like, literally ends with a money shot, unlike regular porn, which is figurative. As we wrap up, I want to drill down, and I hate when people say drill down, but move the plates. You gave the example of moving the plates. I have a fine example of when I sort of switched my way of thinking, and it had to do with ceramics and plates and coffee mugs. And literally, it was a literal example of becoming successful for doing the most mundane nothing task. I'll share that story with you in 1 second. First, let me hit Bet Online. No shortage of action at our exclusive partner, betonline.ag. Sports are coming back. UFC, NASCAR, boxing, soccer. Bet Online has the best odds on upcoming games. And if you need more, Bet Online has simulated NFL, NBA, and UFC daily. Also, live casino games, poker tournaments, and the best props in the business. Visit betonline.ag. Use the promo code podcast1 and use your mobile device. You can join, and you'll get a sign-up bonus. Visit betonline.ag, our exclusive partner, podcast1. Don't forget, promo code podcast1 for your sign-up bonus today. Bet Online, your online sportsbook experts. It is betonline.ag. Yeah, I wrote in a book, my autobiography, Not Taco Bell Material. For me, I used to pull into my house that I rented with my three roommates in La Crescenta, California, and my Isuzu Trooper after doing construction all day. And I would look down at the well, where your feet go on the passenger side of my Zuzu Trooper, and it would always be the ceramic mug that I left the house with that I drank the coffee in on the way out to the job site, and then at some point on the way home, it would be rolling around where the footwell for the passenger. seat. And I would look at it and I'd go, you should take that mug inside the house. And then I would think, well, I can't really reach it from here. I'm going to have to go outside, open the door, and get it from that side. And then I thought, yeah, you don't need to bring it in the house. There's other mugs in the house. You'll get it tomorrow. And then I thought, but tomorrow you're going to have two mugs rolling around down there, and they may break the handle or they may crack because they're rolling around and they're going to clank together. And I thought, yeah, but if you keep one on the seat and you keep one on the floor, then they won't hit each other. And I was like, yeah, but what if I stop suddenly and the one on the seat? And then I thought to myself, just get the fucking mug. You thought about it way longer than you should have. This is insane. Are you going to go through your life this way? Are you going to bargain with yourself every time there's a nominal task to do? Or are you just going to fucking be one of those people that just starts doing it? And I thought, if you see the mug, grab the mug, and that's it. No more bargaining, no more inner dialogue. And I started doing that. And the second I started not negotiating with myself, I started becoming successful.
So that's the idea of self-awareness, maybe, right? Like, you know, just that kind of like, wait, what am I doing here? What kind of person am I? What kind of person do I want to be? I don't think it's guaranteed. I think you could have like gone through the exact same story, but not had self-awareness. And then that wouldn't have been a turning point.
Right. But Stephen was talking about just sort of bussing the dishes back to the sink.
He had self-awareness when he was doing that, though, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I just what I'm saying is these little nothing tasks are, they seem symbolic, yeah, but they're way more than symbolic.
And it becomes a habit because after you decide, no, I'm not going to lose this battle, and it was a tiny battle, then the next battle you're not going to lose is a little bit bigger. And that's how good habits grow. But again, you know, we're like, you know, we're the people who've built those habits,
right?
You know? Right. And then you have kids and then you realize they have to start over. But right. I think that's a lot of parenting, right? Helping kids have those little small wins and those little habits, because like Tuesday is going to depend on Monday and Wednesday is going to depend on
Tuesday. I'm totally fine with small wins as opposed to handing out self-esteem. And no offense to either of your kids who are really shitty athletes, it sounds like, but eighth place, I don't think you should get a ribbon.
Well, to be fair to my son, long distance running isn't really even a sport when you're nine. It's just what you do. You know what I mean? Like, all right. The podcast, No Stupid Questions, Stephen Dubner and Angela Duckworth. This has been quite satisfying, and that hour... hour plus flew by in a nanosecond. So I suggest we do this again soon.
That would be great.
Website, you can go to freakonomics.com, and you can also go to angeladuckworth.com as well. It is so satisfying talking to people like yourselves. I really thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Adam. This was a lot of fun. This was, and I mean, I don't know if you've told these stories about yourself. I know last time I was on, we talked a little bit about your football and stuff and talked about the state of football, but I do think that your reflection on, you know, how you became the person you became, I think these stories, I mean, Angie and I talk about this a lot. Stories are incredibly powerful. Like, you can preach all the like rules of habit making that you want. And most people, like, you know, it's not going to work.
Water through a sieve.
But I hear, like, I'm never going to forget the story of your freaking coffee mug.
Right. Inspired by
I appreciate that.
Your plate. Thank you, guys. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate
it. Nice to talk to you.
All right. Thank you. Last but not least, Simply Safe. No one should feel unsafe at home, period. And that's why they invented Simply Safe. Protect your home today. Get free shipping at simplysafe.com/Adam. All right. Dallas, Texas, Addison Improv coming up this Friday and Saturday. Live podcast and stand-up as well. I'm your emotional support animal. It's available. It's back in stock. Go get it. Get the hardcover and get the audio book as well. And just go to adamcarolla.com for all the info. San Antonio, Texas coming up July 31st through August 1st. And until next time, this is Adam Carolla for Gina and Bald and Steven and Angela saying mahalo.
Stick around. Dave Damashek and Adam Carolla return with Good Sports next.
Sports Network presents Good Sports.
Hi and hello, sports fans. Y'all set for some hot sports talk? I hope you are, because it is time to get into it here on Good Sports. Dave Damashek over here, Adam Kroll over there. What's the poop there, Ace?
I've been thinking about you, Sheck.
Oh, really? Why?
Well, because I've been trying to solve the riddle of the Washington Redskins' new name, and I've been thinking about it a lot. Seriously, I've been thinking about it. And my first thing is, you know, I love the logo. I love the logo. So I'd like to figure out a way to keep the logo, but then honor the logo with something that wasn't, you know, red skin or of something that wasn't a pejorative. And I started to think about a chapter in our history when they used to use the Mohawk Indians, I believe, to build skyscrapers because they didn't have the fear of height that we have. So I don't know. It's a gene. By the way, there's no 5-story teepees. I don't know how this came about. You know what I mean? Like, but they don't
figured this one out. Yeah.
It's a high rise wigwam. No, they,
wait a second. This is a true thing. I've never heard of
this. This is a true thing.
The
true thing is we needed to build skyscrapers in Chicago and in New York and in places like that. And we needed guys to walk along those I-beams, and those I-beams were 30 stories above the ground. And if you can picture it if you haven't. It's one thing to walk across an I-beam that's 8 feet above the ground. It's another thing to do it when you're 30 stories in the air. Your dimensions start, your mind plays tricks on you.
I would definitely, by the way, I don't know if it's a progressive thing, but my sense of balance has gotten way worse.
Yes.
Like if I look over an edge, is that a thing?
Yes.
If I'm up high and I look off the edge, I get that vertigo,
It's an age thing. I completely buy it. So that's what these guys did. So what if we call them iron walkers? Or beam walkers, or iron men, or some industrial iron might, I-beam, you know, something good and strong like that. Now, we got a positive, we can keep the logo, and, you know, I was thinking of you, because, you're from the Steel City, obviously.
I was just going to say, I find it a slap in the face.
What?
That you would name anyone else Iron Man. When the steel that was used to defeat the Nazi scourge back in WW2 was forged by my ancestors, not in our nation's capital or anywhere else, sir.
I just am looking for.
Why attack me, Adam? I didn't deserve this.
I'm looking for a noble, strong name for that team. And, you know, Skywalkers, Iron Walkers, Beam Men, something like that.
I honestly, you know, where I come down on this, they should have changed the name, you know, a quarter century ago, or maybe they should never have even started with it, different time, all that kind of stuff. But I like we've talked about where our the intersection in our Venn diagram on this is, I don't understand it is not on face. The logo is not offensive, you know, I also likewise like Seminoles for Florida State. Apparently, there's some consideration that Florida State may change its mascot. But like, why is that this? I don't see. The offense being committed. Now the tomahawk chop is is another matter. But the name Seminoles on face is not offensive, right? It's the same sort of thing as that logo.
You know, it strikes me, Gary, somebody tweeted me, and you can put this picture up because it'll probably make Sheck laugh, but I did a short pilot for Fox, an animated pilot, called Mr. Burcham. I did my Mr. Burcham. And this is about, it's probably 10 years ago, 9 or 10 years ago. And the very beginning of the movie, or the animatic, as they call it, it's like these are little, you know, they don't do a full pilot. They do like an 11-minute long, 9-minute long animated. The very beginning of it, you can grab a still maybe, Gary. The very beginning of it had him teaching at, when we double click, you'll see. I was way ahead of the curve on this. This is 10 years ago. He taught at a junior high called George Washington Junior High, but it was modified to George Washington Carver Junior High. And yeah. Go ahead, Gary. No, just blow it up. I don't need to run it. And then it was home of the Braves, but the Braves were replaced by the Vikings, and they just put a Viking helmet on top of the Brave. And
that fits kind of neatly. Never mind that the Viking has flaxen hair, but still, otherwise, a pretty easy adaptation to make.
Right. So 10 years ago, we changed the name of the school. We made it into a black theme, and then we took the Indian out. We made it into a Viking, and here we were.
That's pretty clever. As a note, now that you touch on that, it is a fun reminder that it is confusing that the Viking logo, we know his wretched past, what the Viking did, but it's also confusing because he's a blonde, and you don't associate tough guys with that. I mean, no disrespect to Drago. Rocky IV, of course, but usually tough guys have dark hair.
Yeah. It's the shape of the hair. The Viking, Gary, if you look at like,
yeah, it's also
Susie,
the
if you so look at like
tough guys have braids.
If you look at like Cindy Olsen, or now I'm trying to think of, go to Little House on the Prairie. There was a little girl who was a little nemesis on Little House, like the mean girl from Little House on the Prairie, Nellie Olson or something. And she had the exact same little blonde braids that the Viking mascot has, which I would argue that the, you know, Thor is one thing, but the double braided on the Viking, not good. And also,
yeah, it's okay. Yeah. Cause Thor, he doesn't braid. Right. You know, he's not metrosexual.
Yeah, there you go. To take it a, and by the way, to take it a, yeah, the one you had was good. To take it a step further, essentially I had the same hair as the little girl from Little House on the Prairie. Number one, Gary, if you find a picture of that same actress from The Love Boat, you will see the exact same hair. I will also say, if you are a Viking, this is pre-pistols and guns and rifles and everything. It was a lot of hand-to-hand combat, right? Mm-hmm. And I've known, there's two things I've learned from watching chicks fight out front of clubs on TMZ. That hair is essentially a handle that's attached to your head. When you're doing combat with somebody and they grab one of those braids, it's essentially them grabbing a handle on your head, and now they've got a hold of your head and they're hanging
on. Now they got you on their leash. Yeah.
Yeah, you're on a leash.
Now you've leashed yourself.
And now they're throwing knees into your cranium, and there's nothing you can do about it. You've essentially woven two rope handles on each side of your head. Not ideal.
I wonder if when the U.S. military way back when started shaving heads, if this was specifically an addressment of your concerns. Let's not go down. You know what undid the Vikings dynasty, or the actual Vikings ruling a region of the planet Earth? Braided hair.
Well, look at little Nellie Olson. She got the same hair as the Viking mascot. And if you Also, and no, it's true. One of the greatest things I ever saw in the beginning, the early days of the UFC was some asswipe out there with a long ponytail, you know, back when the UFC was just whatever, cage fighting. Mm-hmm. And some dude walked right across the ring, grabbed the guy's ponytail, and just proceeded to keep kicking him. He kept kneeing him over, and he wouldn't let go of the guy's ponytail, and there's nothing the guy could do about it. All right, let me hit Bet Online. Speaking of UFC, you want to do a little UFC action? Might I recommend betonline.ag? UFC, NASCAR, boxing, soccer, it's all there. Best odds for upcoming games. Need more? BetOnline has simulated NFL, NBA, and UFC daily. Also, live casino games as well. Poker tournaments, best props in the business. Visit betonline.ag, or you can use your mobile device to join with the promo code podcast1, and you can sign up. You get a free sign-up bonus. So you get a bonus, and you get to get in on the action. Visit betonline.ag, your exclusive partner at podcast1, and don't forget promo code podcast1 for your sign-up bonus today. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.
Baseball, basketball, the puck, and soon after, pro football action. And last thing, that's why I'm a Troy Polamalu, not a Ricky Williams guy. Ricky Williams had the long hair. He complained when he got tackled by it. Troy Polamalu got tackled by it after an interception when he said, well, I'm the one with the hair hanging out there. I guess that's in play. See, that's the proper response. That's right. The dignified response. All right. More good sports coming at you tomorrow. Until then, for Adam Carolla, Dave Damischek, good sports.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow the Ace Man on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. And be sure to pick up Adam's new book. I'm your emotional support animal. It's available everywhere. Get the links at adamcarolla.com.